Right, welcome to this class. We are going to be talking about the future of work. And that might sound kind of offbeat in the course on innovation theory, but I'm going to argue that the future of work really should be seen as largely a result of innovation. It's an emergent and unplanned kind of macro level outcome of the kind of technological change that we've been looking at throughout the course. And in this class, we're going to look at what technological change we're not going to look at technological change from an organizational perspective, but from kind of the perspective of labor, from the perspective of workers in organizations, and unfortunately also those without organizations. In that sense, the future of work is as much about the consequences of innovation as anything else. And so it's kind of an awareness of technology's consequences that makes it fit, I would say, pretty well into a course of this kind. We're going to start off by looking at the issue of substitution and complementarity between labor and capital, which is kind of an economistic way of saying, will robots take our jobs? And the answer really is that it depends, but probably not. Then we're going to look at how we get paid for those jobs when technology changes. And technological change, in really brief terms, starts off being immiserating for the many, but ends up being pretty important in creating widely shared greater wealth. And finally, we're going to look at the role of decisions that get made in organizations and how they might contribute to shaping the kind of questions that we just addressed. Right, we're going to start off with the paper by David Auteur and his question to the answer or his answer to the question of why are there still so many jobs? That question is interesting because it's not just today that we worry about machines taking over our work. That concern has a pretty long history and people have pretty much always been concerned about machines destroying their livelihoods. Already in that statement, you can see why this is an innovation-related issue, right? The introduction of new machines is a prime example of creative destruction. That said, machines have been taking over our jobs for a really long time, and agricultural employment, for instance, is a good instance of that. There was a time when around 40% of the workforce in many countries were employed in agriculture, and today that's closer to 2% in many developed countries. So clearly, many, many jobs have been lost. And the same pattern applies in many industries, right? And Auteur basically gives a long list of examples here of places where workers have been displaced and replaced essentially by capital. The displacement of workers is what economists call substitution because it's a case of capital replacing labor. If something is done by mostly humans, it's going to be what we call labor intensive. And if something is done mostly by machines, it's capital intensive because it requires capital to buy machines or tools or whatever to do a certain task. Capital can buy technologies that are labor saving, right? And it's quite obvious that substitution is real and that this is what technology does in many areas, right? That's kind of the point. So there's not a lot of reason to dwell on that, right? Does technology destroy livelihoods? Yes, it absolutely does. Does it render certain skills obsolete? Yes. And does it dramatically reduce the need for workers? Yes, by design. That's the point. That's why people invest in technology often, right? But that is not the end of the story. If substitution was all that technology did, there would not be jobs for all of us today. But as it turns out, mostly the jobs are there, right? You all are kind of looking forward to a situation of being employed. You may have spells of unemployment, but you won't be what's called technologically unemployed. Because basically what happens is that technology sometimes makes human work more valuable. And that's what we call complementarities. As Auteur puts it, tasks that cannot be substituted by automation are generally complemented by it. Most work processes draw upon a multifaceted set of inputs: capital and labor, brains and brawn, creativity and rote repetition, technical mastery and intuitive judgment, perspiration and inspiration, adherence to rules and judicious application of discretion. Typically, these inputs each play essential roles. That is, improvements in one does not obviate the need for another. If so, productivity improvements in one set of tasks almost necessarily increase the economic value of the remaining tasks. Right, long quote. A couple of different things to notice, right? So first is the issue that some tasks are hard to automate, right? The interesting thing here is that is the question of what those tasks are. And basically we're witnessing a gradual progression in what machines can viably do, but there are still things that they cannot do, right? At one point, the easy thing to automate was the brawn of human work, right? Monotonous muscle movements. And today we see AI, artificial intelligence, doing things that we thought was clearly the preserve of humans. But to some extent, automation still requires tasks to be relatively repetitive and routine in order for them to be done by machines, right? That doesn't mean that routine tasks are necessarily amenable to automation, right? Both because some routine tasks take a large element of tacit knowledge to perform. That's what's known as Polanyi's paradox, and because some apparently low-level tasks are simply very difficult to automate, right? Plucking a BlackBerry, for instance, is very hard for a machine to do, but totally routine and very simple for people to do. And that's called Moravec's paradox. Also, it often turns out that there are non-routine components to what appear to be routine tasks, right? For instance, when bank transitioned from bank tellers to ATMs, it became apparent that bank tellers had been doing more than simply handing out cash, right? They had been producing customer experience of various kinds and basically doing more than what was the apparent work they were doing. And these kind of non-obvious auxiliary tasks tend, ironically, to become obvious only after automation has occurred or failed, depending on how important that non-obvious auxiliary task was. The second thing to notice is that Auteur focuses on tasks. He's not talking so much about entire jobs. So as I kind of alluded to above, most jobs are a composite of many different tasks. There was a time when being an engineer or an accountant meant doing lots and lots of calculations, right? You basically used a slide rule or a calculator, and later a computer, to do lots and lots of your work. And basically, automation has gotten rid of a lot of that, like, base calculation sort of work. But they haven't gotten rid of the job, right? There are still lots of accountants and there are still lots of engineers. Construction work is often seen as one of those jobs that can't be automated because so much of what gets done is contingent on, like, conditions on the ground. And yet we can see that parts of construction can get done in factories through kind of a reliance on prefabricated building components, such that some part of construction does get automated, but those parts are contingent on ground level conditions remaining manual, right? So parts of jobs can be automated, and some tasks that comprise the job can be automated, right? The third, and this is really the kicker, is that automation is something that often increases the value of the things that don't get automated. When parts of our job become automated and more efficient, we can become more efficient in our job, right? So take a banal example. When I calculate the average grade of students in a 400-person course in less than 2 seconds using Excel, I just freed up time for preparing a lecture or writing a paragraph or whatever. And that means that we can do more valuable work and can increase how much value we produce, right? Sometimes that gets kind of linked into what's called the O-ring principle, right? So if you have a chain of super high efficiency operations, the value of improving the lowest efficiency operation is going to be very high. That last statement has a couple of caveats that are worth noticing. For instance, in order to become more efficient at those non-automatable parts of your job, you have to be good at those parts, right? So an engineer who was only good at calculations is going to have a hard time in a world where computation is cheap and cheerful and gets done by sophisticated software on powerful machines, right? Also, if demand for a particular good does not increase as automation increases, jobs do get lost, right? While the Industrial Revolution is kind of a fantastic example of cheaper textiles, implying that people just buy lots more clothes, automation of agriculture and the ensuing cheaper food did not mean that people ate more beyond a certain point of satiation and a difference to food waste, at least. And if non-automatable tasks can be done by anyone and not just those people whose job have been automated, those people might find their livelihoods threatened and their jobs threatened. So if the difficult work, for instance, of diagnosing diseases can be automated and a medical visit can become a question of just asking a patient a series of questions that get provided by a computer, there's no real reason why a highly trained doctor should be doing that work instead of a person with a more limited education. And if military aircrafts can be remote controlled by game-savvy teenagers, so much for all those years that a pilot spends in flight school. Right? Same thing, a lawyer who is only good at writing up standard contracts will struggle when that becomes an automated process, while the creative lawyer who's capable of doing complex mergers and acquisitions deals will probably continue to do well, right, for a while at least. So these are questions of what economists call elasticities, right? So how does a change in, say, the price of a good affect the demand for it? How does a change in price impact supply? How does a change in a household's income affect the extent of what it consumes of different goods? And those questions matter for what increased efficiency ends up implying, right? Irrespective of that, though, what is clear is that complementarities change jobs, right, by changing the relative weight of different tasks in those jobs. So irrespective of whether you're a construction worker or a nurse or a university professor or an engineer or a factory worker, technology is going to push you to do more work of the kind that machines can't do and to become more efficient at them. And those changes can clearly be really, really dramatic. But aside from these questions of how technology shapes existing jobs, there is also the issue of technology creating new jobs, right? Either by expanding demand for particular kinds of work that already exist, or by creating entirely new job categories. An example of the first, right? There are many, many more managers and doctors and engineers and university professors around today than there were 100 years ago. And of the second, there are more people today working as graphic designers and personal trainers and baristas than there have been before, right? Those professions have either been super limited or non-existent, say 100 years ago. But what's interesting to note about these developments, right? This expansion of some professions, the destruction of others, and the emergence of third ones, is that they tend to bring, at least in the present, a kind of job polarization, right? The jobs at the top and bottom of the wage distribution tend to expand in number because of the kind of automation that we're currently seeing, right? While those jobs in the middle of the distribution tend to be easier and more valuable to replace. And this basically creates a pressure on wages at the middle of the income distribution, because workers from that part of the distribution tend to get pushed into lower paid jobs, at least right now, when they lose their old ones. They contribute to the increased supply of workers at lower paid jobs, and thus they create a pressure on the wages at the low end of the distribution. And that means, effectively, that everyone but those at the top of the wage distribution suffer from automation. Those who are not at the top, at the top of the distribution may have jobs, but those jobs will not necessarily be particularly good ones, right? So that kind of sets up nicely, I think, the discussion of how technology impacts work, right? The fearful outlook is that of substitution. The optimistic one is that of complementarity and the invention of new professions. And together, they kind of paint a picture, as you might expect, of technology's creative and destructive sides. other two papers that we're going to read today are going to nuance that, I think, in interesting ways. So the first one is that by Bessin, and it's basically work on textile workers during the Industrial Revolution. And it's going to look at why, even when there are obvious complementarities that make workers more productive, workers may not be benefiting, right? Despite being complemented by technology, your job may not be particularly good. And how can that be? That's going to add an important dimension of time into Auteur's ideas. And the other paper by Liu and her colleagues is going to show how the question of complementarity is bound up with the kinds of opportunities that firms discover and exploit in a technology in order to pursue different strategies. Right? In that sense, their work is about how complementarity is less an inherent property of a technology and more a function of choices between different alternatives that may or may not be equally apparent and equally attractive to all parties. And with that, we're going to pause for this first paper.